Thanks for inviting me into your home. Long-haul truck, RV, camper, taxi. Your parents' well-appointed rec room. Your loft. That greasy spoon just off the interstate. And your cabin in the woods. Welcome to Coast AM. I'm Richard Serrett, sitting in for the intrepid George Norrie. And tonight, this morning, we're coming to you live from Coast's Toronto, Canada affiliate, In-Depth Radio, News Talk 1010. Old 1010. This radio station is what we call a heritage station. It's been on the air for about, 80 years. In fact, it was my very first job in talk radio here at 1010. We used to call it CFRB. I started working back here in the early 90s, and I ended up meeting my wife, the mighty Aphrodite, here at 1010 after we married. We had our twin boys who were born. Now get this, the 10th month, the 10th day, October 10th, at 10 minutes after 10. A lot of 10s in our family. And of course, Mom and Dad met and fell in love at CFRB 1010. So there you go. Coming up in hours 1 and 2, Lieutenant Colonel Robert McGinnis, or as we say up here in Kanuckistan, Lieutenant Colonel Robert McGinnis, retired. He says America is locked in a new kind of dual Cold War with the Russians and the Chinese. The Russian Federation, under a populist authoritarian leader, seriously threatens the West through cyberspace and military, thanks to that country's heavy investment in sophisticated mass-killing weapons. The People's Republic of China is a great power with global ambitions, led by a new kind of communist leader focused on rapidly growing his nation economically and militarily. And together, China and Russia collaborate to dominate our future, and that pseudo-alliance could well become the catalyst that leads to the prophetic end times. Lieutenant Colonel Robert McGinnis, author of Alliance of Evil, is here for hours 1 and 2. Hours 3 and 4, let's see, what shall we do? I thought maybe we could exchange some veal recipes, because there's absolutely nothing going on, right? I actually remember slow news days back in the 90s, when we would sit around and say, wow, there's nothing going on. Well, that certainly isn't the case these days. When was the last time we had a slow news day? Open lines in the last half hour of this audio transmission. Of course, there's the murder of Saudi journalist Khashoggi. There are migrants on the march from Honduras. There is the midterm elections on the horizon. We could talk about all that stuff. But, let me just throw this log on the fire. And I think it's the single most important question out there. Even more important than who wins the House, who wins the Senate, which party will get to stack the various courts with judges of their choosing. Yes, more important than all of those things. And that is, in many ways, it's the only question that matters. What happens after we die? I'd love to hear from people who have experienced a near-death experience or have had an after-death encounter, an encounter with heaven, hell, angels, or, yes, even demons. And given what Lieutenant Colonel Bob McGinnis is about to reveal, it might be a good time to start contemplating our mortality and discuss what lies beyond the Great Veil. Welcome to the Audio Imaginarium. Come on in, weary traveler, hang your cloak on a peg, grab a stool, and come gather around the fire. There are stories to be told, and you are among friends. I'm Richard Serrett, sitting in for George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. Why don't you stay a while? Welcome back to Coast AM. Richard Serrett, sitting in for George Norrie. Lieutenant Colonel Robert Bob McGinnis, U.S. Army, retired, is an experienced and internationally known expert on national security and foreign affairs. He currently serves as a national security and foreign affairs analyst for Moody Broadcasting Radio Network, Salem Radio Network, and is a regular On several other radio networks, he recently completed a year as a Fox News military analyst. He's a senior systems analyst with BCP International Limited, an Alexandria, Virginia-based company, where his primary duties include working on multinational programs for the Department of Army. And since October of 2002, Colonel McGinnis has been a member of Security Donald Rumsfeld's Military Analyst Group, and his brand new book is called An Alliance of Evil: Russia, China, the United States, and a New Cold War. Has the mystery of the end times finally arrived? Bob McGinnis, welcome back to Coast to Coast. How are you?
I'm doing well, Richard. Thank you for having me this evening.
My pleasure. Let me throw a couple of items at you very quickly. And one is that we are hearing that U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton is reportedly pushing the president to withdraw from a treaty designed to prevent a nuclear arms race between the U.S. and Russia. That would be called the INF, or the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, which has been in place since 1987. Your thoughts?
Well, of course, the Russians are suspected, and I think a lot of people would agree, in violation of the 1987 INF Treaty, because they have not only built but practiced the use of ballistic and cruise missiles that have a range of 500 to 5,500 kilometers in violation of that. We've tracked a cruise missile we call the 9M729 that has, not met the criteria. It's violated the criteria. Now, of course, John Bolton is on his way this coming week over to Moscow to talk about that. But they're also, Richard, going to talk about the possible renewal of the 2010 New START. And, President Trump said weeks ago that perhaps we aren't going to renew it. And that should be a shot across the bow of Moscow, because it should concern us all that, that has cut back dramatically nuclear weapons to 1,550 deployed strategic warheads and about 700 vehicles. So, this is important in a world that I believe has really crossed the line to a new Cold War, because the old Cold War was all about nuclear holocaust and the threats posed by the Soviets and the U.S. We're entering that new era right now.
I want to also dial back to September, when Russia began its largest ever military exercise with 300,000, just think of that, 300,000 soldiers. This was a drill with China as a rehearsal for some sort of large-scale conflict. It was called the Vostok 2018 drills. Just this kind of really illustrates how China and Russia are aligning themselves, perhaps against the United States.
Well, it does. And in fact, really yesterday, you had the two defense ministers from Russia and China met, and they're getting ready to jointly head a commission on military technology that is, of course, being chaired significantly between the two. We just sanctioned the Chinese for buying fighter jets from the Russians, and also the S-400 surface-to-air missile system. And the Vostok 18 exercise, as you indicate, had 300,000 soldiers, 36,000 armored vehicles, at least 1,000 bombers. Some of those strategic bombers, in fact, flew off the east coast of Russia straight at the United States, practicing what I would consider bombing runs against Shimia, Clear Air Force Base, and Fort Greely. Fort Greely is where we have the mid-range nuclear anti-missile capability, and we're growing that, mostly because of the North Korean threat. But of course, the Chinese have a rising capability, and the Russians has never gone away.
I want to ask you whether there was an opportunity lost after the fall of the Iron Curtain, the end of the Cold War, when President Reagan had essentially vanquished what he called the evil empire, the Soviet Union. And then later, assurances were given to the Soviets or the Russian Federation that NATO would not encroach one centimeter towards Moscow. And of course, that was violated. Some might suggest that the United States was poking the bear, and given their passion for nationalism in the former Russian Federation, coupled with the ascension to power of many who it would suggest is perhaps the greatest Russian leader since Peter the Great, that this was an opportunity lost, that the United States provoked the Russians, and they could have been allies, but now here we are. What are your thoughts?
No, I think you're correct, Richard. We did poke them, and of course we've continued to do that. They considered Ukraine the breadbasket of Russia, and of course they're continuing to fuel the anti-Kiev civil war, which I call in the eastern part of the country, and that's after having seized Crimea and, of course, two provinces in 2008 from the Republic of Georgia. And they're pushing back against the Baltics, against Poland, Hungary, Romania, the entire former Soviet satellite regimes. That's something that I know when Mr. Yeltsin, the new president after Gorbachev stepped down, came to this country, met with Bush at Camp David, we had the opportunity to do more than just give them a few crumbs. We could have brought them into the fold. And I think that really, as you indicate, fueled the rise of Vladimir Putin. And, Putin, of course, has captured the imagination of the Russian people, and as a direct result has really fueled nationalism and patriotism in a way that they're somewhat, I would argue, blind to perhaps what the West is looking at, because they want to rise again. They want to be a great power again. And they do have the means through their nuclear arsenal. And, of course, Putin, here even this week when he was down in Sochi, was arguing that, we have a modern weapon systems that really push against the emergent and the very capable West. And he talked about the avant-garde, a 20-time speed of sound, nuclear-capable, go-anywhere, break-through-any defense system, weapon system, hypersonic weapon system, much like what the Chinese are working on. So the Russians are really fortifying themselves. They're pushing back. They are concerned about NATO, and we did violate the initial trust that we wouldn't push against them. We did. And so we find ourselves in a very dangerous position today, vis-a-vis not only, of course, Putin, but also President Xi in China.
How much has the narrative of Russian collusion handcuffed the Trump administration into perhaps smoothing over relations, pulling us back from the brink, if you will? Because now, because everyone is seeing a Russian under their bed, in the closet, in the White House, that he has to appear almost overly aggressive against the Russians. How much has this Russian collusion narrative endangered American national security?
Well, I think that it has, and in fact, Putin said once again this week that he believes that Trump clearly wants to stabilize and improve U.S.-Russian ties. When they met together in Helsinki this July, they talked about a host of issues. Now, of course, all those are not out in the open, because presidents talk in confidence about things of concern. But one of the things he talked about was the reduction of nuclear weapons throughout the world. And, of course, it starts with both Russia and the United States. I think that President Trump is pragmatic. He does want to, kind of get the rhetoric lower, not only with the Russians, but with the Chinese. Now, people will argue, well, what's he doing with this trade war and the like? Well, he's representing, if you look at the national security strategy and the national defense strategy that were published in the last year, he is trying to make sure that people understand America is first. He's not going to sit back and see other countries take advantage of us, but at the same time, he does want stability. He does want to end the tensions. But at the same time, it's very high today for a variety of reasons.
Well, let's pivot to China. You mentioned the trade wars. And how people need to appreciate how this trade war strategy, or tariffs against China, is not just economics, it's also national security. And that if, I would argue, if we don't engage in this trade war now, we're going to have to end up fighting on the battlefield later. Is this an attempt to weaken China significantly economically so that they can't achieve military supremacy over the United States?
Well, clearly we have, as the number one and number two economic powers in the world, there is a lot of competition, but there's a lot of commonality, a lot of mutual interest to keep both economies going along. You know, the Chinese in the last year or so have seen somewhat of a dip. They're at, 6.5% growth in the last quarter, which is down over the previous quarters. But the fact is that we need one another. And yet, if we continue to allow them to take jobs, to manipulate our businesses and rob our intellectual property, and Trump says, well, we're losing something like $300 billion of intellectual property to Chinese, not only cyber attacks, but through company-to-company relationship and company-to-state relationship with Beijing, then that's a national security issue. He makes that very clear in the national security strategy that economics is national security. We can't afford to lose jobs. We can't afford to let our wealth go to China. And so he's trying to level the playing field. He wants a fair playing field. Arguably, President Xi has said much the same, but from a very different position. And so they're hopefully going to meet within the month, maybe in Argentina, we'll see. And if they do, maybe we can get kind of movement in the right direction. I know the Chinese media is trying to figure out Trump, just like the ambassador to Washington from Beijing said on Fox News this past weekend. They can't figure him out. And I think that's to the Americans' advantage. You always want to keep your opponent, your adversary, or even your friends to a certain degree guessing. And Mr. Trump certainly does that.
This, you call it alliance of evil between the Russians and the Chinese, and perhaps there are other components to this, Islamic terrorism perhaps. But in terms of the Russians and the Chinese becoming bedmates, is this driven by ideology in any way? Are there still vestiges of communist ideology here, or is this simply about hegemony?
Well, it's a combination of things. It's not as simple as communism versus liberal democracy as it was, I would argue, during the old Cold War. Putin, for his own ideology, is about order and bringing jobs back to Russia, bringing confidence in where the nation is, as opposed to what they would call an amoral West. And the things that they represent. They paint the West as what Hollywood is spewing all over the world, and they said, you don't want that. In fact, Putin is famous for embracing Christianity and family values and the things that used to resonate in the United States in the 50s. So he, even though he's authoritarian, he still is perceived widely as a leader of the common man in Russia. And as a result, there's a lot of confidence in him. Yeah, he has adversaries, but, it was just this week you had, a gentleman by the name of Valery Zorkin, who was the chairman for the Russia's Constitutional Court, who even started to, hint at perhaps we ought to amend our constitution, much like the Chinese did this past year, and allow Putin, in this case, to serve beyond 2024, because he was just elected, of course, this past March. They're beginning to see that we need longevity, and we need to have capability to keep the momentum going, and they feel confident that Putin is doing that, much as the Chinese are feeling confident in President Xi as well.
You're not exactly painting Putin as an evil adversary, and yet the title of the book is Alliance of Evil. So Why should we, aside from the fact that the Russians have a vast nuclear arsenal, why should we be fearing Putin and an alliance with China?
Well, what they're doing is they're weaponizing everything against us. You know, if you look at political coercion, predatory economics, strategic extortion, information warfare, covert action. You know, I could go through every one of those, Richard, and there's a long history. And in fact, in Alliance of Evil, I go through 16 indicators in which those things just come out alive, and they're like blinking red lights, and they suggest very strongly that, yes, they're representing their interest. And in fact, Russia and China are collaborating, just like the Russian prime ministers have been, Russian Chinese prime leaders have been meeting here recently, and their defense ministers just met, you know, for umpteen time over the
last. Bob, sorry for the interruption. I got to jump in here. We'll pick this up on the other side. Alliance of Evil, Lieutenant Colonel Robert McGinnis. Here is Jimi Hendrix taking us into the break with Voodoo Child on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Great to be with you on a Friday night into Saturday morning. Say hello at Richard Serrett. S-Y because I love you, R-E-T-T. All right. A newscast on Argentine television came to a screeching halt late last week when the anchor spotted an unidentified flying object soaring over the city of Buenos Aires. The strange sighting reportedly occurred on the program Mañanas Argentinas last Wednesday, as anchor Mariela Fernandez was standing in front of a giant screen which showed the city skyline and marveling at the unsettling amount of smog in the air. And then she suddenly caught sight of a UFO. She was clearly amazed by what she was seeing. Fernandez quickly pointed out the anomaly to her co-host Diego Angeli, and the odd object appears to be a silver sphere that quickly moves across the sky and eventually vanishes from sight when it flies off screen. While we're unable to discern exactly what the anchors are saying, it seems clear that Fernandez was stunned by the oddity's rapid speed. That said, one local account of the incident indicates that the duo may not have taken the sighting all that seriously, as the segment was described as hilarious. Well, you can check that out for yourself. It's in the highlight carousel up at Coast to Coast AM. Back with more of my conversation with Lieutenant Colonel Robert McGinnis as we discuss the Alliance of Evil right here on Coast to Coast AM. Lieutenant Colonel Robert McGinnis, the author of Alliance of Evil, Russia, China, the United States, and a New Cold War, has the mystery of the end times finally arrived. Who do you perceive as the greater threat right now to the United States, Russia or China?
The immediate threat, Richard, is Russia, given their provocations, but also their military capability, which they're not shy to exercise around the globe. The Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral Richardson, has said recently, we're in the fourth battle of the Atlantic. The first one was in World War One, the second one, World War Two. The old Cold War was the third one. The Russians have put in place a nuclear submarine and a diesel-powered submarines that are just as capable, almost, as certainly ours, not only in the Atlantic, but in the Mediterranean and elsewhere. And, of course, they're confronting us militarily in the air. They're back off our coastlines. They're very aggressive in terms of cyber, as we know all about the allegations and justifiably the sanctions put in place because of their interference in the 2016 election. And here recently, in the 2018 midterms, we arrested someone, of course, this was a Chinese person, in Belgium. You know, these sorts of things are not to be ignored. The Russians are bellicose in their, you know, claims against us, and to a certain degree, we're pushing back. You know, President Trump's not, backing down. And that, given that there's, you know, some give and some take, but maybe it's not favoring an outcome that is going to suit us all. And then, of course, you join that with what's going on with the Chinese, perhaps in the South China Sea, East China Sea, and of course their Belt and Road Strategy initiative all over the world, where they're buying up infrastructure and using that as a way of planting their People's Liberation Army capabilities literally across the globe. You know, though I say Russia is more dangerous, China is certainly the long-term more dangerous adversary.
Well, we vanquished the former Soviet Union economically. We brought them to their knees. They have an economy which is, what, their GDP about the size of Texas.
Yeah.
Why couldn't we do that again with another arms race?
Well, we are in an arms race. I mentioned earlier the hypersonic weapons that Putin puts forward. Keep in mind, you know, you're right, their GDP is minuscule compared to ours, but they hide a lot of this stuff, so it's not really as obvious as one would think in terms of how much they're really plowing into their capabilities. He said this week, you know, we have these capabilities, and our experts don't contest that. Yes, they are working on capabilities, and they probably will field them in the near future. And are they willing to use it? Well, Putin says, you know, he's not going to be the first to use nuclear weapons, even though, you know, there is a strategy called escalate to de-escalate, which is in their 2015 doctrine, that, in fact, they might use tactical nuclear weapons, which is, you know, why the U.S. Congress in the National Defense Authorization Act 2019 wants to fund a new counter to that, to provide us a tactical capability in Europe. So you've got all of these kind of fluttering around there. I would say right now, because of the capabilities that Russia is posing against NATO, and the, of course, the more strategic capability that he's been modernizing with his platforms and his weapons, that they're the near threat, the long-term threat, and especially if they collaborate as they are, as I pointed out earlier, with the defense ministers consistently meeting, and you mentioned the Vostok 2018 joint exercise, which is going to be an annual exercise. These sorts of indicators demonstrate that these two nations are, you know, pushing back against the former, you know, dominance that we had across the world. And arguably, you can, you know, come up with the conclusion, I think, that perhaps we're not as dominant, and perhaps we are weakening. Certainly, up until the Trump administration came in and started to refuel our defense industry and our Pentagon to have capabilities that we were really bleeding, and therefore were not able to stand toe-to-toe with the rising Chinese military. And of course, though not as big as the former Soviet Union, the Russians have capabilities that clearly we don't have, and we're trying to catch up with even now.
Let me ask you about NATO. Article 5, of course, the cornerstone of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. An attack on one member of NATO is an attack on all of its members. Should we really go to war with Russia if, let's say, they roll tanks across the Estonian border? Do we want to go to war, maybe World War III, over Estonia?
Well, that's why, you know, Trump has been over there, you know, trying to shake them up, saying you've got to spend more. And you know, even the idea of accepting Macedonia, we already have 29 members. Do we need all these other little countries? You know, might Russia go in and disturb that country, and then, as you're right, declare Article 5 and we have to go to war? Now, there's only been one declaration. Of course, that was 2001 when we were attacked, you know, in New York and Washington and Pennsylvania and the like, and we declared a war on terror, and we're all over the place, to include Afghanistan, et cetera. So, no, I don't think that we should, you know, jump at that. And I think that's what is in the back of Trump's mind, says, you know, I'm not sure I want to throw my entire nation's capability and wealth and stature and future into the hands of these little tiny nations that may not have the wherewithal not only to push back against the Russians, but to you know, make these tough decisions. So that, I think, is very much on the forefront. That's what John Bolton perhaps is going to talk to his counterpart in the Kremlin next week. You know, certainly, you know, the defense ministers are talking that. I know the General Dunford was just over at his counterparts in NATO, and he was saying, look, you folks, you've got to wake up. And he said, yeah, they are waking up to the threat posed by Russia. But we as a nation, certainly the United States, had better make it very clear that if we can't back an Article 5 declaration by even one of these little tiny countries that are threatened, Lithuania or Estonia or even Poland, which is very concerned about the Russian bear and what they might do, perhaps similar to what they did with Ukraine. These are all issues of great magnitude that we've got to decide. And thus far, we haven't backed out of NATO, but perhaps that's something we need to rethink.
Let's talk about China. We've been hearing all about Russian collusion in elections and so forth. Nikki Haley, the UN ambassador, and the president has accused the Chinese of meddling in the midterm elections. There's obviously a huge amount of economic integration with China and the United States. The big concern, as I see it, again, comes back to cyber warfare. All these talks about Chinese-made computer chips and components and electronics that may have a back door, even in U.S. military equipment. Talk to me about the seriousness of that threat.
Well, it is a very serious threat. And in fact, over the last year, and certainly at the Pentagon, the Defense Secretary, Jim Mattis, put out a mandate, say, look, even in these Chinese-made phones, we're not going to sell them in our post exchanges, our stores. We're not going to buy certain items because we're suspect that the Chinese have somehow put chips in these devices that can turn on and transmit information that we don't want to lose. So it's not only impacting individuals, it's impacting the institution. And of course, you're right. We're in bed with the Chinese on all sorts of economic activities, building equipment that through second and third level contributors to a large end item end up in the U.S. military. And that's why I think that a lot of people are concerned. The Chinese established this year the Strategic Support Force, which got our attention because it centralizes within the People's Liberation Army the space, cyber, and electronic warfare capabilities. And, these are an organization that is run at the very highest level, basically for strategic purposes. And we're concerned that it will manipulate the information at a strategic level that will harm our interest, not only interference of elections, but certainly jeopardize our dominance in space, our satellites. Of course, the Chinese have an anti-satellite capability. They're shooting literally for the moon. They're building a capability to put a space station up very shortly. Now, they're doing the types of things that maybe 20, 30 years ago, we as the United States were talking about and beginning to do. Well, they're rapidly catching up. And, this has caught our attention. That's why, the president and the Pentagon wrote a national defense strategy that focused like a laser on Russia and China as true competitors, near peer competitors across the board. And it's not just the military, it's the economic, it's the diplomatic, it's all these other areas that show national capability and national power. And we're finding that our adversaries are doing quite well, thank you.
How concerned should we be with the fact that Google, arguably one of the most powerful companies in the world, and your monopoly on the distribution of or dissemination of information appears to be in bed with the government of the People's Republic of China and is helping them censor information in that country?
Yeah, they're manipulating algorithms so that they can monitor their own population. And, of course, they won't negotiate any longer with the Pentagon on those types of things, the use of the cloud, et cetera. That's disturbing. They are a U.S. company, and you would think that they would have some allegiance to this country and not become a pawn in the hands of the communist leadership in Beijing, and yet that's exactly what they're doing, I suppose, to a certain degree, because they see a rising Chinese economic power, and they want to be part of the success of that country. You know, they will, you know, by a lot of estimates, be the world's leading economic powerhouse by 2035, you know, somewhere around there. And unless something dramatically happens in a very different way, they're going to achieve that. And they're going to have a leverage using what I outlined earlier, the Belt and Road Initiative, which is pouring hundreds of billions, you know, maybe a trillion and a half across the world, and arguably at least 68 countries, where they're buying infrastructure and they're buying markets and they're controlling information flow, you know, i.e. the internet and what can be used and what can't be used. So they're strategically doing some very bright, very smart things, but when you look at their autocratic regimes and their president for life under President Xi and the amendment of their constitution, and you're seeing something similar under Putin with the possibility of ruling for a long period of time and the collaboration across all these fronts, sharing of technologies, and kind of they kind of have to love one another because the rest of the world doesn't seem to like them, except they're beholden to them because they're being bought up to a certain degree by the Chinese.
I want to ask you about Saudi Arabia and how important it is for the United States to maintain this alliance with a bad actor in a bad neighborhood, given, of course, the Khashoggi, the brutal slang of Khashoggi, and how that might, I mean, there are dominoes at play here, obviously. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on how we should proceed, or how the United States or the Trump administration should proceed with Saudi Arabia, and how that plays into all of this sort of this dual Cold War scenario.
Yeah, it's never simple, is it? The Khashoggi situation is tragic, but if you've been watching Mohammed bin Salman, you know, the crown prince, you know, he's probably been cut down a few notches here recently, especially with the so-called Davos in the desert, which he was expecting all these donors and investors to come over and pat him on the back and give him more money so he can develop a true economy that's not based solely upon petroleum. We have a lot invested in the Saudis. We have a lot of Americans over there, a lot of technology. They're totally dependent upon our arms. And of course, now they could go to the Chinese or Russians, but they don't want to because ours typically are much better. I think the big question in that part of the world, one, is oil, and how are they going to use dollars in the future, but also Iran. Iran is not to be trifled with, and of course they're their major adversary against the Saudis. And the Russians and Chinese are lined up with Iran, and we're lined up with the Riyadh regime. They're Wahhabist. They've got a way of doing things that certainly in the West we're not all excited about. But the reality is that a friend of my, my friend, what's the expression, Richard? A friend of my enemy is a, my friend or something like that. The idea being that we have to have partners in that part of the world. It's a dangerous game that they're playing. We see that evolved over the years in Iraq. We see it in Syria. Even Vladimir Putin would just welcome President al-Sisi of Egypt up into Moscow for his fourth visit in the last couple of years. And, they made big arms deals, and they're talking nuclear power plant in Dabah. So these sorts of issues are on the forefront. If we abandon the Saudis now, they will run into the arms of Putin, and Putin understands that, or into the arms of Xi, and to a certain degree that's happening. We have to recognize in the dark side of the world, very bad things happen. Our own government has been involved over the decades and very bad things we don't publicize.
All right, Bob, sorry for the interruption again. I've got to cut in here. We'll pick this up on the other side. Bob McGinnis, Alliance of Evil.